Dan, so I'm sorry you couldn't join us last weekend.
Thank you
for that interview. But you were able to watch what we did there with
Absolutely.
Chris.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Are there any comments that you would like to make about what you just viewed?
Yes, I would like to say that Chris, and I mean, we met, he gave a talk at the library in Mobile, Alabama about, Florence Maybrick and the diary. And that was maybe 10, 12 years ago. And we just really connected. We both realized that we were passionate about Florence Maybrick, about her innocence. And we decided to write a book that would exonerate her, at least in history. And I believe we did that with this current book. But prior to that, my background in the Ripperology, I guess you could say, arena was that I spent a lot of time in London and just on my own became, kind of fascinated with the East End and Arthur, Morrison. Like, I read, People of the Abyss, Child of the Jago, and that was the setting and background for the Ripper killings. That's where all of that took place. And I met, Paul Feldman, and he connected me with Anne Graham. And maybe because I'm an outsider, an American, whatever, but I was sort of in a unique position. And I went to Liverpool and met with Anne, who was very gracious. And I spent the day with her. We had dinner and I got to know her. And we've been in touch for the past 20 years. And as Chris said, she is very touchy about the, she considers Jack the Ripper and all of that very gory and very gauche and is not interested in discussing that. And of course, the diary is definitely off the table. So to be her friend and to be supportive, I just, unless she wants to open up to that, I let it be. And she's a very bright lady, very, very, very smart. And she was, just very, very helpful taking me to, all over Liverpool to the different sites, where Florence and James, where they lived. And we went to the courthouse where the trial was held. And she talked with me about how she was there alone and how she could imagine this trial proceeding and how Florence and the doc must have felt. And that's how that helped her write her book, The Last Victim. And I thought that was a great insight. And Feldman thought I should write a book about Florence as well, but I wrote an article in the Ripperologist instead, from the Mobile perspective. Donald Rumbelow, I have to credit him for encouraging me to go to Mobile and do some research. And that's what I did. So.
That article was the babe of
Mobile. Babe of Mobile.
and that was 22 years ago now.
Yeah.
Ripperologist issue 32. So any of you out there who are track that down via the digital copies of Ripperologist, you're going to be SOL. This was way back when Ripperologist magazine was just through printed copies. Now, I received an email from Keith Skinner a couple of days ago.
Yes.
Going back to Anne Graham.
Mm-hmm.
How you can square, discussing the Florence Maybrick case with her and everything like that. How can you square that with her believing that she claims to have seen the diary in 1968? Is this just, was was there just like a contract drawn up basically saying that, you know, we can be friends as long as you never mention the Diary of Jack the Ripper? Because she does claim that she viewed the diary in 1968.
Right. And so did not think much of it at all. Right.
How do you guys handle this?
We don't. It's just something that I think would be kind of incendiary or just an unwelcome topic, a topic to avoid unless she wants to open. I know I have not confronted her about that. It's something that would have to come from her. You know, I've mentioned it and that's all I can do. And if she doesn't want to add detail, that's just how it is right now. And maybe she has reasons or legally has to remain silent about that. I don't know.
I'll ask one more question from Keith, which does have to do with what you had just referred to and what Chris mentioned in our interview about the legal ramifications, potentially keeping people silent. Keith wants to know what evidence you might believe that there might be some legal repercussions, considering that nothing happened when Mike Barrett claimed to have created the diary in 1994. Nothing happened when he made his affidavit in January 1995, implicating his wife, father-in-law, Tony Devereaux, and naming his daughter as a witness to the proceedings. So what would anyone be afraid of, considering there's never been any legal ramifications for anything that's happened up to this point?
I don't have any specific evidence of that, only that, you know, I know that she was interviewed by Scotland Yard, that I think that was a traumatic experience for her. And with the diary, Robert Smith, you know, I mean, they're, you know, you're referring to something that has a lot of value. People are invested in it. It's a litigious society or culture that we are in. And so I think I would not be surprised if there were things that she would not talk about publicly, possibly. And that's something I could talk with her. I would ask her about that, but I can't say with 100% certainty that there is some kind of, you know, restraining order or something that has to be kept in abeyance or secret. I'm not sure. Theoretically, probably. And Chris may have more to say about that.
Well, I agree with virtually everything Dan said. I think sometimes it's perceptions rather than reality. If you believe there might potentially be a legal problem, even if there isn't one, if you believe there's one, then that's going to affect the way you're going to act. The Barrett confessions, which some of them were made when he was drunk. In fact, one of them, his own solicitor immediately said was nonsense. So I think people by and large just ignored them. But if somebody now came forward, whoever it is, with a statement and they're perfectly sober, perfectly rational, then there might be legal ramifications. In fact, I think there probably would be, because a lot of money was made from the book that Shirley Harrison wrote. So even if Keith's right, nothing would actually happen. But if you believe that something might happen, it will cloud your judgment. It will affect how you act.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, John, do you want to tackle some of the questions from our audience?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I've kind of sorted these. So I'm going to start off with the ones about, you know, the Maybrick case, and then we'll get on to the diary and then the other peripheral issues that may surround it there. So first of all, this is one from myself. What would the physical effects or benefits or motivations be for someone like James Maybrick to take arsenic and strychnine and other such substances?
All right. One, you know, I know Chris and I have talked about that. In my research, it indicates, you know, like Chris has mentioned, there is a something like a 20-year difference between Florence and James. I think she was 18 and he was like maybe 40 years old. You know, he was much older. And I think as time went by, she, you know, as Chris mentioned, kind of came into her own as a kind of, you know, maybe introverted, hypochondriac kind of young lady. She became more confident, and that led, of course, to an affair. I think James, as he aged, he used these medications more frequently to counter the psychological and physical effects of decline. And being around Florence, I think, reminded him of that all the time. She was very youthful, energetic, and he was not, you know, or he had to work at it because he was in his 40s. And he used that, the medication is like an aphrodisiac. And as he called it, a pick me up. And he relied on that. And it's well documented, of course. And I met with several physicians, even a coroner. And we talked about arsenic and strychnine, and those medications are damaging cognitively. So the idea, and I don't want to get too far afield or digress here, but I'll just say, in terms of James Maybrick as JTR, the fact that he was using these drugs would preclude his being a suspect, because Jack was agile, a quick thinker, fast on his feet, you know, physical. That was not James Maybrick. A nice guy, and you could interact with him, but the strychnine, arsenic, just very damaging, and really would work against someone being that serial killer.
If I just and have a
statement quickly.
Sorry, Dan. Totally agree again with everything Dan said. Just to add a couple of other quick points, because I'm not sure how much your listeners will all know. First of all, he was a serious, serious hypochondriac, and he would take all sorts of drugs in all sorts of crazy dosage. Secondly, it looks like, although we're not 100% convinced by this, he first took arsenic as a way of tackling the malaria that he contracted when he was in when he was based in Norfolk, Virginia. He tried quinine, it didn't work, and arsenic was put forward as another remedy of trying to tackle that illness. So he sort of stumbled in it, and his the very nature of his being as a hypochondriac, he started to take more and more. And Dan's absolutely right. He called it his pick-me-up. It gave him a bit of strength. And there's one area of the book which we'd like to do a little bit more in the future. He went to see a guy called Dr. Seagard. It was in Paris. He was a physician who experimented with monkey glands, and he believed that it would rejuvenate an individual. And he actually was the guy who prescribed for James Nux Vomica, which contained strychnine, low dosage, but nevertheless a dosage that was actually used to kill rats. So a pretty serious amount. He stumbled into it. And as Dan said, he needed to take more and more of it, he thought, because he wanted to keep you as youthful as possible. But of course, the more he took, the worse he became. So it was a spiraling out of control. Hence, we argue very much in the book that it was strychnine that really brought him to the edge of death. So rather than helping him, ultimately, it killed him.
Yeah. Chris, you saw the reference to where his tongue was black from all this?
Yeah, if you look at the symptoms that he suffered from, close to his death, for instance, that the colour of his tongue, as it was often shown by the doctor. And also, by the way, his arms were kept twitching, his limbs were twitching.
Yes.
That's a classic sign of strychnine abuse. As I say, so much of the stories written about James and Florence is the story of arsenic. There's even a wonderful book by Trevor Christie, which has got arsenic in the title. But in our minds, it was strychnine was the one that you really... because you could access that much more easily. Arsenic was quite difficult to access later on in his life. So strychnine was the one, his drug of choice, the one that he used the most, and the one that really, even his own brother Edwin actually said at one point, about a week and a half before he died, he said to another mutual friend, strychnine is killing James. So pick me up. But eventually a killer.
Okay, so the next question I got is from Amanda Lloyd. Going back to the 19th century, do you feel that Michael set up the allegations of murder and was behind Florence's arrest? She believes she read somewhere that he was already selling stuff from the house before the trial.
Good question. Chris?
Michael is an important person in this story, absolutely no doubt about it. And for once again, if not all your listeners know, Michael was James's younger brother, but he was very much the most important of the brothers. He was a famous celebrity in his day. He was a composer of music. This is a mistake in the diary. The diary said he was the lyricist. He wasn't. He was composer of music, of tunes. He was a famous singer, and he performed right across the Western world. He was possibly, in the 1880s, Britain's leading popular singer. He'd also performed in America. He was a very important Freemason. He was on the national body of the Freemasons, and he was a friend and associate of the Prince of Wales, who was the next in line to the throne after Queen Victoria. So you're talking about a pretty powerful individual. And in that age, in an age of deference to such people, when he comes onto the scene, there's no doubt about it that the police officers were quite intimidated by his presence. And they would listen to what he had to say. Now, it's our view in the book. What we suggest is this, is that when he arrives at Battlecrease, when James is seriously ill, he's shocked. We don't see Michael as the architect of James's death, but we do see him as an architect of what happened afterwards. He was the one who gave evidence to the police rather than the police finding the evidence. And we think that some of that evidence was filtered. So, for instance, some of the letters that were written to Florence from one of the other brothers, Edwin, disappeared. But the letters from Brearley, who she did have a brief affair with, all were there. We think some of the items were moved. So
he worked against Florence.
He did work against Florence. Now, did he sell things? He did, yes, because to some extent that had to happen because the house was empty. It was an expensive house. It was a big house. It's, you can still see it today, but the land that was attached to the house has been sold off. So you don't today get the sense of the grandeur of the place. Mm-hmm. But if there's nobody living in the house, why maintain it? Florence was desperate for money because she had this expensive trial coming on. So Michael and his other brother, Thomas, they did organise the sale of all the property. And they did so without Florence's permission, which is obviously underhand and wrong. But it wasn't altogether a crazy thing to do in the sense that Florence did gain money from it. She gained quite a sizable amount of it, which did help pay for, go towards her trial costs. Michael is an important figure, and he's one who's very much involved in what happened, I think more so after James's death. But nevertheless, in the last few days before James died, he took control of the house, and him and his other brother, Edwin, simply said to the nurses and the other people who were looking after James that Florence couldn't have any responsibility at all. Even so, if I give you one simple example, Florence suggested that James should have a hot water bottle. And she couldn't do anything. That had to be processed by the nurses there. Florence was simply, you know, she was made redundant in her own house.
Right.
Her
she was marginalised.
Absolutely totally. Marginalised. That's the right word. Thank you, Dan. Marginalised. And her treatment was shocking. And in fact, and after James died, her two children are moved out of the house without her even knowing. And she never saw them again. Mm-hmm. It's a shocking story. What happened to Florence is simply shocking. And as Dan said before, in many ways, we're much more interested in the Florence story than we are with the diary story. And we were very keen to get to the truth of what happened. And in the book, we have two final chapters. And chapter 24, we look at the evidence against Florence for being, you know, the potential murderer of James. And we are 100%, absolutely, no doubt about it, clear, Florence did not murder James Maybrick. She deserves to be pardoned.
And this is actually a related question. And I think you've already half answered it. Chris Hardman-Dodd asks, should Florence now receive a pardon? And if so, would it make a difference?
Ooh. What do you think, Dan?
Well, I think that maybe 50 years ago, no one knew who Florence Maybrick was. She was kind of lost to history until the diary was found. Had that diary not been found, we wouldn't know. But now that we do know about this woman and her background, absolutely, she should be pardoned. She was innocent. And we document that in this book. You know, we go further than Christie and, you know, other authors who have, you know, gone down this path. We found new information, and I think there's no question about it. Most people would agree that she was innocent.
I think Dan's right again. I think the case wasn't completely lost, of course, because obviously it was one of the things that led to the establishment of the Court of Appeal in this country. So it wasn't an important case in that sense. But does she deserve to be pardoned? Well, I think many people think incorrectly that she was pardoned when she was released. She was initially sentenced to be hanged in Walton Jail in Liverpool, and five women were hanged in Walton Jail in Liverpool. But there was such an outcry against the sentence that the Home Secretary listened to a lot of people and decided to commute a sentence to life in prison. And she spent 15 years in prison. And on a couple of occasions, she nearly died in prison. She was released and she returned to America. And it is a widespread myth out there that when she was released, she was pardoned. No, she wasn't. She was released under license.
Right.
And in fact, the Home Office had the right, if she breached the terms of her conditions of her release, to put her instantly straight back into prison, which is one of the reasons why she went straight initially to France, but back to America. Possibly visited Britain again. We're not 100% certain about that, but she was never pardoned. Does she deserve to be pardoned? Absolutely. Will it make a difference? Well, obviously it won't make a difference to her. It won't make any difference to her children because she had two children who were both dead and neither of them had any children. However, you know, it's an injustice. An injustice is deserved to be put right, whether it's about Florence or it's about anybody else.
That's right.
You know, it deserves to be put right so that in the accounts about the trial, her name is cleared.
Chris, I think it's absolutely on target.
Your book goes into, you know, folks writing and all these appeals for her release. Why do you suppose all of these efforts to get her release kind of fell on deaf ears for so many years?
Well, you know, Queen Victoria was very much against, you know, Florence or any, you know, it was the time period. It was political is the long and short of it. We tried, there were many friends of Florence Maybrick that raised money to you know, win her release, wrote letters. These things would usually make a difference, but because the Queen was so, you know, like entrenched in her belief that, you know, she was a murdered her husband, and until her passing, there was not much that could be done.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just going off of memory in your book. Do you not suggest that some of these letters didn't even reach the Queen? They were like stopped by the Home Secretary or something, who just said, oh, well, she's not going to even pay
attention. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Dan's 100% right that the Queen Victoria felt that Florence was guilty. And the thing that I mentioned slightly before was that until the early part of the 20th century, there was no court of appeal in this country. That once you were found guilty, that was the end. So to get somebody released from prison was actually quite a difficult process to go through. And the Home Office, which was responsible for law and order in this country, was pretty opposed to it, because you would, by releasing somebody, you'd be saying, well, we got it all wrong. And, you know, the British legal system didn't want to say we made a mistake.
Right.
You know, they'd be saying,
that's right.
Yeah, so we've made a mistake. We've got it all wrong. There were rumours, which we put in the book, that they had some sort of secret evidence, but it doesn't exist. You know, all the records are now, you know, if anybody wants to see the records on the trial, you can go to the National Archives in Kew. And there's four boxes on the Florence's case, and you can get them out and go through them. It's a wonderful experience to do. I've done it. And you can go through all the evidence and weigh it up. But the bottom line is the British legal system didn't want to admit it made a mistake. The Queen was opposed to it. And also, possibly as well, some of the ways in which the Florence campaign went about it was a bit heavy-handed. You know, people didn't like it that they were, you know, nobody likes to be told that you're wrong, and nobody likes that you're being told that you're wrong in a very loud, vocal way, which was happening. So it, rather than helping the process of releasing Florence, it probably reinforced the entrenched position of the British legal system. And Dan's absolutely right. It was only after the death of Queen Victoria that Florence was released.
And Chris, I think you would agree that, you know, we found that the British legal system was reformed. I mean, there were changes made because of Florence's case and how it was mishandled. And it did have to acquiesce somewhat, and it did have that positive effect.
Yes, that is true.
It was a curious in that you guys kind of set it up to where she was basically her goose was cooked before the trial was even over, is essentially what you got, the point that you guys make, because of what the corruption is what I would basically call it, in the legal system. And it does bring to mind other cases like the Crippen one in particular. Not that I'm a proponent of Crippen's innocence, but over the last decade, there's been a weird trend to argue that Crippen was wrongfully convicted of his crime. So when I was reading your book, it didn't make me second guess Crippen's guilt necessarily, but it did make me question as to how widespread this apparent bias against criminal defendants were at the time in the justice system back then. And could someone like a Crippen be put in the same situation as someone like Florence, to where, you know, well, we arrested him, so we have to convict him, kind of a thing?
Good point. And, you know, because of all of this, Florence went on the lecture circuit to talk about prison reform in the early, like 1907, 1908. She was going around giving talks, getting paid for it, but talking about something unheard of, this prison reform idea. And so she was you know, she could be very, very assertive and made some changes that were positive. And she always had standing ovations. So she must have been, there's no video that I've seen of her giving a talk. I would love to hear that. But everything that I've read has been unanimously in her favor as a, you know, wonderful speaker, very effective. And she didn't have to do that, but she did. She went out and pushed for prison reform, toured different prisons here in the United States, talked to the prisoners. So her experience was profound, those 15 years in a harsh English prison. And she put that to use. You know, she didn't just bury it, to her credit. She was a strong woman.
Can I just go back? Once she certainly was a strong woman, Dan's absolutely right. Just go back to the trial for a second. And you said that we use the word corrupt. And I can see, understand why you use the word corrupt. I don't think it's the right word, though. Let me explain that. Before the trial, at the inquest, Florence's solicitor and later and afterwards a barrister's never really properly responded to the charges against her, because there was a circumstantial case against her. You know, in the book, we don't belittle the case against her, but the case was circumstantial. You know, there were certain unfortunate things. So, for instance, she bought fly papers which contained arsenic at the very moment that her husband became ill. That was an unfortunate thing. So there was a case to be answered.
When I was saying corrupt, I was more like the judge read the inquest. He was made privy to the inquest testimony. Right. But then there was testimony at the inquest that would have gone a long way to exonerate her that was never brought up at trial. So it seemed almost like it was rigged to where you said there was witness.
I don't think that there was evidence brought up at the inquest that would have gone a long way, because at the inquest, there was only the prosecution really presented any evidence. And
what about James's drug habits and all this? All of this information about his...
Yeah, but that wasn't brought up at the inquest. One of the things that's so unfair about the inquest was that, well, there was lots of things. You know, the chairman of the jury was somebody who knew James. A couple of the members of the jury had been to James's funeral. The evidence against... There was no evidence at the inquest that supported Florence's case. It was a completely unfair process. But you're right. After the inquest, then there was stories started to feature in the press about James's drug use. That started to appear, and that started to change things. So what you see at the trial, so for instance, at the very first day of the trial, when Florence is moved from Walton Jail to the court, she's booed. But by the end of the trial, as she's moved from the jail to the courthouse, she's cheered. There's a great change of amongst the public about whether she's guilty or not. What didn't change, though, and this is where I understand the word corrupt, was the attitude of the judge. The judge's role in the case was pivotal. He was very much a misogynist. He was a man who believed that a woman who was unfaithful to her husband was a woman who was capable of murder. So in many ways, the charge against Florence was driven not by any criminal factors, but by morality and the morality of the one-sided morality of this particular judge.
And the Victorian culture.
Calhoun book is very good in that particular point, because she looks at it very much from a woman's perspective and the way that the different standards and the way women were treated. And just to give you one simple example. So for a man to get a divorce, he just simply had to show that his wife had been unfaithful. But for a woman to get the divorce, she had to show more things. She had to show that not only the man had been unfaithful, but he'd also been cruel as well. So there were different standards in law. There were also different standards in the norm of society, of the norms of society, and the way that women were viewed and treated. So Florence got an unfair trial, and that reflected the unfair nature of Victorian society towards women. And that was made even stronger because you had a judge who, in his summing up, which lasted 2 days, was undoubtedly biased towards Florence in his summing up. And it definitely influenced the jury. I'm not as corrupt, I don't think is the right word, in the sense that corrupt sort of implies there's some sort of monetary financial gain. But what I do think was, although corrupt might not be the right word, completely unfair and biased, I would absolutely 100% agree with you.
Florence,
it was a mistrial, in my opinion. Unfair. Florence was unfairly treated.
Even in the Chris, modern day, that does tend to be a thing as well. Women look them harder compared to men for certain offences. I'm just going to move us along very quickly, you know, skip forward 100 years now to the diary. We've already kind of touched on this topic, but Steve Rivers has asked on Facebook, with Mike Barrett confessing the diary was a forgery in a sworn statement, why is there still so much debate that the diary is authentic? Is his statement discounted due to his hostility towards a few others he was making business deals with? Such as Paul Feldman. So you've already kind of discussed some of the contradictions and the withdrawals of statements and stuff like that, but why is there still a debate about if it's genuine or not, do we think there, gents?
Well, I didn't hear the comment about Paul Feldman. What was that?
Basically, he was asking, do we think that the statements that Mike Barrett has made has been discounted due to his hostility towards people such as Paul Feldman?
Well, I think Chris, you know, he spent time with Barrett. So, Chris, I mean,
the simple answer to the question is that Mike Barrett's confessions aren't really coherent or rational. So he within those, first of all, they're all inconsistent. You know, they say different things at different times, and some of them were fueled by alcohol. And as I said before, even his own solicitor immediately said, hang on, step back from this. This is nonsense. But in his most detailed confession, he says quite a few things about how he accessed the ink. And he got it from, it was a diamine ink, and he got it from a particular place in Liverpool, and where he got certain other, you know, where we got the scrapbook. And some of those things don't actually hold true. You know, the ink, for instance, he said he purchased, tests on the composition of the ink don't match up with what he said. I can understand why, you know, his confessions are inconsistent, they're incomplete, and in occasions they're inaccurate. You know, and he said some things which you can show aren't true. So they do lack credibility in their totality. However, there are certain things you could unpick within them that would suggest that maybe, yes, he did have a hand in or a part to play in the construction of the diary.
Yeah, as he seemed to know some things, but not other. He didn't know the technical details, but...
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
But he got some things factually wrong as well.
Yeah.
So it didn't help.
Yeah. Okay, another Facebook question, and this is not on the diary this time, but the watch. Matt Dre is asking, what do you make of the test results into the investigations into the watch?
Okay, well, I picked that one up if you wanted it as well. There's been two tests, as far as I'm aware, that I've seen. I've got copies of them anyway, or I've got summaries of them. Two detailed tests into the watch, and both of them suggest people who think that the watch is genuine will tell you that the reports say, well, you know, the watch could be, the markings that were made on the watch could be many years old. But both reports also say they could also be a fake. One of the things that is said is that within the scratches that were made, where he said, I am Jack, and the initials of the five canonical victims, there are little fragments which are very old. Well, that's not very difficult to do if you use an old implement to make the scratches. If you use a very old implement to make scratches in a watch, then you're bound to have within those scratches very old little markings and pieces of metal and other little bits and pieces.
Right.
So I'm not as convinced by the science as what some other people are, or some people are anyway. But the simple fact is this: if the diary is a forgery, then the watch is a forgery. That's it. Simple as that. And it's telling, isn't it, that the watch suddenly appeared 9-10 months or whatever it was after the diary suddenly appeared. You know, none of these things were around for 100 years, and all of a sudden, wham, bam, they both come together. No, that's the watch is a fake. Clever fake again, but it's a fake.
Okay, and the final question now, this is actually a question of mine. What are your feelings on Bruce Robinson's magnum opus and his accusations against Michael?
he hasn't read the book.
Yeah. There is a chapter. I'll just say we deal with different questions in the book. And one of the things that we asked was Michael Maybrick Jack the Ripper? And it follows on directly from the Bruce Robinson book, They All Love Jack. And in our opinion, by the way, I enjoyed the book. I thought some of the language in the book was a bit bizarre. But I
don't think I even got a quarter of the way through his book. I just gave up because it could have been so much shorter if he didn't just have to prefix everyone's name. And yeah.
Well, I've read his book at least three times because there's things about his book. What I like about his book, even though I fundamentally disagree with it, what I like about his book is it made me think. It made me question certain of my own assumptions. It made me look again at Florence's trial. Because he makes certain statements about the way the trial was conducted. And by looking at some of the points he makes are just completely and utterly inaccurate. They're wrong, factually incorrect. And it helps the whole premise of his theory then collapses around it. So do I believe Michael Maybrick was Jack the Ripper? Absolutely not. If James is an entirely unlikely suspect, Michael Maybrick is a totally incomprehensive suspect. But what we do in the book is we look at aspects of Bruce Robinson's book that relate specifically to Florence's trial, and we show how some of his statements are just simply inaccurate. So, for instance, one of his arguments is that the British establishment wanted to frame Florence and get her convicted and then get her hanged. But of course, she was convicted, but she wasn't hanged. And one of the people who strongly fought to get her released was her actual, the person who represented her at the trial, Russell. And he wrote a long, detailed article, which you can still see in the National Archives, in which how we said how the case had been badly run by the judge. In fact, he doesn't call it trial by jury, he calls it trial by judge, because, as going back to an earlier question, how the judge played a pivotal role. And all that doesn't square with any of the things that Robinson says in his book. So it's an interesting book that I actually enjoyed, but it's a book that's fundamentally flawed in so many areas. Mind you, we probably think that about our book. That's the nature of debate.
And I think that's it. That's all the questions that we've had in and that I've got.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Chris and Dan, for joining us for question.
It's an honor and a pleasure to be with an esteemed group of Ripperologists. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
And can I say exactly the same? I've really enjoyed last week, and thank you very much for the courteous way that you know and positive way that you've dealt with us and supported our book. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
We could go on all day with you, but this was great. Thank you.
Absolutely.
We'll do it again.
I agree. It could go on for much longer, but unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. You both are welcome to come on my show individually to further discuss the Maybrick case because I find it fascinating.
I'd love to. There's great. a lot more to say, obviously.
Absolutely.
So, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.